The Moon Pool by A. Merritt. Chapter 3. The Moon Rock. "I do not intend to tell you now," Throckmorton continued, "the results of the next 2 weeks, nor of what we found. Later, if I am allowed, I will lay all that before you. It is sufficient to say that at the end of those 2 weeks, I had found confirmation for many of my theories. The place, for all its decay and desolation, had not infected us with any touch of morbidity. That is, not Edith Stanton or myself. But Thora was very unhappy. She was a Swede, as you know, and in her blood ran the beliefs and superstitions of the Northland, some of them so strangely akin to those of this far southern land, beliefs of spirits of mountain and forest and water werewolves and beings malign. From the first she showed a curious sensitivity to what, I suppose, may be called the influences of the place. She said it smelled of ghosts and warlocks. I laughed at her then. 2 weeks slipped by, and at their end the spokesman for our natives came to us. The next night was the full of the moon, he said. He reminded me of my promise. They would go back to their village in the morning. They would return after the third night, when the moon had begun to wane. They left us sundry charms for our protection, and solemnly cautioned us to keep as far away as possible from Nantauoc during their absence. Half exasperated, half amused, I watched them go. No work could be done without them, of course, so we decided to spend the days of their absence junketing about the southern islets of the group. We marked down several spots for subsequent exploration, and on the morning of the third day set forth along the east face of the breakwater for our camp on Ushchin Tau, planning to have everything in readiness for the return of our men the next day. We landed just before dusk, tired and ready for our cots. It was only a little after 10 o'clock that Edith awakened me. "Listen," she said. "Lean over with your ear close to the ground." I did so, and seemed to hear, far, far below, as though coming up from great distances, a faint chanting. It gathered strength, died down, ended. Began, gathered volume, faded away into silence. "It's the waves rolling on rocks somewhere," I said. "We're probably over some ledge of rock that carries the sound."
"It's the first time I've heard it," replied my wife doubtfully.
We listened again. Then through the dim rhythms deep beneath us, another sound came. It drifted across the lagoon that lay between us and Nantauoc in little tinkling waves. It was music, of a sort. I won't describe the strange effect it had on me.
"You felt it?"
"You mean on the deck?" I asked. Throckmorton nodded. "I went to the flap of the tent," he continued, "and peered out. As I did so, Stanton lifted his flap and walked out into the moonlight, looking over to the other islet and listening. I called to him.
"That's the queerest sound," he said.
He listened again.
"Crystalline, like little notes of translucent glass. Like the bells of crystal on the sistrums of Isis at Dendara Temple," he added, half dreamily.
We gazed intently at the island. Suddenly, on the seawall, moving slowly, rhythmically, we saw a little group of lights. Stanton laughed.
"The beggars!" he exclaimed. "That's why they wanted to get away, is it? Don't you see, Dave? It's some kind of festival. Rites of some kind that they hold during the full moon. That's why they were so eager to have us keep away, too."
The explanation seemed good. I felt a curious sense of relief, although I had not been sensible of any oppression.
"Let's slip over," suggested Stanton.
But I would not. "They're a difficult lot as it is," I said. "If we break into one of their religious ceremonies, they'll probably never forgive us. Let's keep out of any family party where we haven't been invited."
"That's so," agreed Stanton.
The strange tinkling rose and fell, rose and fell.
"There's something very unsettling about it," said Edith at last, soberly. "I wonder what they make those sounds with. They frighten me half to death, and at the same time, they make me feel as though some enormous rapture were just around the corner."
"It's devilish uncanny," broke in Stanton. And as he spoke, the flap of Thora's tent was raised, and out into the moonlight strode the old Swede. She was the great Norse type, tall, deep-breasted, molded on the old Viking lines. Her 60 years had slipped from her. She looked like some ancient priestess of Odin. She stood there, her eyes wide, brilliant, staring. She thrust her head forward toward Nan Thawach, regarding the moving lights. She listened. Suddenly she raised her arms and made a curious gesture to the moon. It was an archaic movement. She seemed to drag it from remote antiquity, yet in it was a strange suggestion of power. Twice she repeated this gesture, and the tinklings died away. She turned to us.
"Go,"
she said, and her voice seemed to come from far distances.
"Go from here, and quickly. Go while you may. It has called,"
she pointed to the islet.
"It knows you are here. It waits,"
she wailed.
"It beckons the...
She fell at Edith's feet, and over the lagoon came again the tinklings, now with a quicker note of jubilance, almost of triumph. We watched beside her throughout the night. The sounds from Nan Thawach continued until about an hour before moonset. In the morning, Thora awoke, none the worse, apparently. She had had bad dreams, she said. She could not remember what they were, except that they had warned her of danger. She was oddly sullen, and throughout the morning her gaze returned again and again, half fascinatedly, half wonderingly, to the neighboring isle. That afternoon the natives returned. And that night, on Nan Thawach, the silence was unbroken, nor were there lights, nor sign of life. You will understand, Goodwin, how the occurrences I have related would excite the scientific curiosity. We rejected immediately, of course, any explanation admitting the supernatural. Our symptoms, let me call them, could all very easily be accounted for. It is unquestionable that the vibrations created by certain musical instruments have definite and sometimes extraordinary effect upon the nervous system. We accepted this as the explanation of the reactions we had experienced, hearing the unfamiliar sounds. Thora's nervousness, her superstitious apprehensions, had wrought her up to a condition of semi-somnambulistic hysteria. Science could readily explain her part in the night scene. We came to the conclusion that there must be a passageway between Ponape and Nan Thawach, known to the natives, and used by them during their rites. We decided that on the next departure of our laborers, we would set forth immediately to Nan Thawach. We would investigate during the day, and at evening my wife and Thora would go back to camp, leaving Stanton and me
to spend the night on the island, observing from some safe hiding place what might occur. The moon waned, appeared crescent in the west, waxed slowly towards the full. Before the men left us, they literally prayed us to accompany them. Their importunities only made us more eager to see what it was that, we were now convinced, they wanted to conceal from us. At least, that was true of Stanton and myself. It was not true of Edith. She was thoughtful, abstracted, reluctant. When the men were out of sight around the turn of the harbor, we took our boat and made straight for Nan Tawak. Soon its mighty seawall towered above us. We passed through the water gate with its giant hewn prisms of basalt and landed beside a half-submerged pier. In front of us stretched a series of giant steps leading into a vast court strewn with fragments of fallen pillars. In the center of the court, beyond the shattered pillars, rose another terrace of basalt blocks, concealing, I knew, still another enclosure. And now, Walter, for the better understanding of what follows, and... He hesitated. Should you decide later to return with me, or, if I am taken, to follow us. Listen carefully to my description of this place. Nan Tawak is literally three rectangles. The first rectangle is the seawall, built up of monoliths, hewn and squared, 20 feet wide at the top. To get to the gateway in the seawall, you pass along the canal marked on the map between Nan Tawak and the islet named Tau. The entrance to the canal is hidden by dense thickets of mangroves. Once through these, the way is clear. The steps lead up from the landing of the sea gate through the entrance to the courtyard. This courtyard is surrounded by another basalt wall, rectangular, following with mathematical exactness the march of the outer barricades. The seawall is from 30 to 40 feet high. Originally it must have been much higher, but there has been subsidence in parts. The wall of the first enclosure is 15 feet across the top, and its height varies from 20 to 50 feet. Here, too, the gradual sinking of the land has caused portions of it to fall. Within this courtyard is the second enclosure. Its terrace, of the same basalt as the outer walls, is about 20 feet high. Entrance is gained to it by many breaches which time has made in its stonework. This is the inner court, the heart of Nan Tawak. There lies the great central vault with which is associated the one name of living being that has come to us out of the mists of the past. The natives say it was the treasure house of Chow Te Lur, a mighty king who reigned long before their fathers. As Chow is the ancient Ponopean word for both sun and king, the name means, without doubt, place of the Sun King. It is a memory of a dynastic name of the race that ruled the Pacific continent, now vanished, just as the rulers of ancient Crete took the name of Minos, and the rulers of Egypt the name of Pharaoh. And opposite this place of the Sun King is the moon rock that hides the moon pool. It was Stanton who discovered the moon rock. We had been inspecting the inner courtyard. Edith and Thora were getting together our lunch. I came out of the vault of Chow Te Lur to find Stanton before a part of the terrace studying it wonderingly. "What do you make of this?" he asked me as I came up. He pointed to the wall. I followed his finger and saw a slab of stone about 15 feet high and 10 wide. At first all I noticed was the exquisite nicety with which its edges joined the blocks about it. Then I realized that its color was subtly different, tinged with gray and of a smooth, peculiar deadness. "Looks more like calcite than basalt," I said. I touched it and withdrew my hand quickly, for at the contact every nerve in my arm tingled as though a shock of frozen electricity had passed through it. It was not cold as we know cold. It was a chill force, the phrase I have used, frozen electricity, describes it better than anything else. Stanton looked at me oddly. "So, you felt it too," he said. "I was wondering whether I was developing hallucinations like Thora. Notice, by the way, that the blocks beside it are quite warm beneath the sun." We examined the slab eagerly. Its edges were cut as though by an engraver of jewels. They fitted against the neighboring blocks in almost a hairline. Its base was slightly curved and fitted as closely as top and sides upon the huge stones on which it rested. And then we noted that these stones had been hollowed to follow the line of the gray stone's foot. There was a semicircular depression running from one side of the slab to the other. It was as though the gray rock stood in the center of a shallow cup, revealing half, covering half. Something about this hollow attracted me. I reached down and felt it. "Goodwin, although the balance of the stones that formed it, like all the stones of the courtyard, were rough and age-worn, this was as smooth, as even-surfaced, as though it had just left the hands of the polisher." "It's a door!" exclaimed Stanton. "It swings around in that little cup. That's what makes the hollow so smooth."
"Maybe you're right," I replied. "But how the devil can we open it?"
We went over the slab again, pressing upon its edges, thrusting against its sides. During one of those efforts, I happened to look up and cried out. A foot above and on each side of the corner of the gray rock's lintel was a slight convexity, visible only from the angle at which my gaze struck it. We carried with us a small scaling ladder, and up this I went. The bosses were apparently nothing more than chiseled curvatures in the stone. I laid my hand on the one I was examining and drew it back sharply. In my palm, at the base of my thumb, I had felt the same shock that I had in touching the slab below. I put my hand back. The impression came from a spot not more than an inch wide. I went carefully over the entire convexity, and six times more the chill ran through my arm. There were seven circles an inch wide in the curved place, each of which communicated the precise sensation I have described. The convexity on the opposite side of the slab gave exactly the same results. But no amount of touching or of pressing these spots, singly or in any combination, gave the slightest promise of motion to the slab itself. "And yet, there what open it," said Stanton positively.
"Why do you say that?" I asked.
"I don't know," he answered hesitatingly. "But something tells me so. Throck," he went on half earnestly, half laughingly, "the purely scientific part of me is fighting the purely human part of me. The scientific part is urging me to find some way to get that slab either down or open. The human part is just as strongly urging me to do nothing of the sort and get away while I can." He laughed again, shamefacedly. "Which shall it be?" he asked. And I thought that in his tone The human side of him was ascendant. "It will probably stay as it is, unless we blow it to bits," I said.
"I thought of that," he answered. "And I wouldn't dare," he added soberly enough. And even as I had spoken, there came to me the same feeling that he had expressed. It was as though something passed out of the gray rock that struck my heart as a hand strikes an impious lip. We turned away, uneasily, and faced Thora coming through a breach on the terrace.
"Miss Edith wants you quick," she began,
and stopped. Her eyes went past me to the gray rock. Her body grew rigid. She took a few stiff steps forward, and then ran straight to it. She cast herself upon its breast, hands and face pressed against it. We heard her scream as though her very soul were being drawn from her, and watched her fall at its foot. As we picked her up, I saw steal from her face the look I had observed when first we heard the crystal music of Nan Tawak. That unhuman mingling of opposites! End of chapter 3.